You're listening to Decisive Point. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the author and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm talking with Andrea Maloof today, author of Iraq's Ministry of Interior, NATO Capability Building and Reform. You can read it in the summer 2024 issue of Parameters. Maloof is a consultant and advisor in institutional reform, conflict analysis, stabilization, and strategic planning / evaluations. She's worked on projects for the UK's Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office, Home Office, the US Department of State, Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the United Nations Development Program, and the EU. Welcome to Decisive Point, Andrea.
Thank you, Stephanie. It's great to be here.
What inspired you to write this article?
NATO were having a changeover in leadership, and they wanted to be able to arm the new leadership with a bit of an independent view on what had happened in terms of Ministry of Interior reforms. They'd been doing that for quite some time. So initially, a few years ago, they asked me to do this bit of research, looking at lessons and issues that had come up. And that then inspired this article, obviously, which I then developed with their permission, of course.
You identify 10 strategic errors or lessons from this mission related to ends, ways, means, and assumptions. Lesson one talks about the ends, defining a clear and coherent end state. Will you expand on this lesson for us, please?
Yes. But before I do, I just want to say that what is really important to note in regards to this is that although NATO were really interested in the results and in reflecting a little bit on what they had done, and NATO is not the primary driver, it's not the primary funder of efforts to support the Ministry of Interior in Iraq and to support these reforms. They were just the ones who were interested in reflecting on what they were doing. So I think a lot of the lessons that emerge from this paper, yes, they're relevant to NATO, but really they're probably a lot more relevant to some people with more cash being injected, the donors giving a bit more cash into trying to help improve the Ministry of Interior's capability in the country. With that massive caveat, because it would be unfair to lump all of these problems on NATO, given that they're not the primary actor, I'm very happy to talk about the first lesson, which is about defining an end state. And it's important to also bear in mind that actually I just use that framework of ends, ways, and means as a rapid diagnostic tool because we all get it. And defining a really solid or clear even end state is the hardest bit of it, even though it's a starting point. And it's hard because often we let our tools determine what we think the problem is. And we come with our own institutional and organizational biases and lens through which we perceive an issue. If we don't define the right end state at the beginning, we have really no hope of trying to achieve it because then it's just playing a game of chance. And chance to win at what exactly? It's not very clear. You'll see in my article that that's probably the shortest segment, but it's really the most important one. And it's the bit that requires a great deal of departmental, organizational deconfliction and deconfliction with other actors. So in the case of Iraq, with the US, with the UK, with the EU, with many others to really get at what really are we trying to change. And then we can look at how we change it.
Lessons 2 through 5 address ways, training, political will, and trust in the security sector.
The most important thing to know here is that training is a lever. It's not even a very strategic lever, but we can call it that. Training is a component and a tool you can use in institutional reform. It absolutely is not the objective in itself. Really understanding how best to leverage training requires a much more comprehensive bit of analysis into what the problems are and, of course, what you're trying to change. If you've set out your objectives, what you're trying to change, then you can look at your obstacles to achieving that. After that, you can begin to look at what the desired end state might be in terms of really changing those specific behaviors, who you might need to influence. And then somewhere down the rung is what they need to know. So it's only all the way down that we get to training. It's certainly not the framing tool. Training is really just a process. It's an important one, maybe, to change certain behaviors and certain processes, but it really is not the be-all and end-all. But if you've set your end game as we need to get 100,000 people trained to become police, then you will just focus on training as getting you there. You may have entirely missed the point. How effective is the police? How trusted is the police? Are they working well with the public? Can they enforce the law at all? Are they even institutionally legitimate? Will other parties work with them? All of that is missed because we're just looking at numbers. So maybe I would say ignore training until the very, very last moment. But I recognize that that is upending the way things are done in capability building.
Means. Applying human and financial resources covers lessons 6 through 8.
Once you've defined your ends and then you've decided on how you're going to do it, or really what you need to change to achieve that and what the problems are in a very kind of detailed sort of way. And by the way, although I say detailed, really, if you just go through the system, I've seen people on a smaller scale, of course, do it on the back of a fag packet or a napkin. And even that is better than not doing it at all. For anyone there thinking, oh, but we don't have the time or we don't have the money, you really don't need all that long if you've got the right people in the room and someone to facilitate the asking of these questions and to push people into a certain direction. You can do that within half a day. And believe me, that's probably half a day more than many people spend on defining problems, unfortunately. So after you've done all that homework, you need to get to the practical things. And it's very much a negotiation. You just look at your budget and whether you have the right team to deliver it. And those are the practical constraints that we ought to consider, because if we realize there is a mismatch between our risk appetite, our budget, the configuration of our team, then we need to go back and say, okay, well, maybe we need to moderate our expectations. Or if we've defined a problem set as being A to E, we decide we're only going to work on D and E and not ABC. That's where the practical decisions really need to be made, as well as knowing what we're going to do. We need to be very clear on what we're not going to do, and therefore what we won't be able to affect or change. Honestly, I don't think I've ever seen that done explicitly. And working with all these actors that I have worked with in the past, it's very rare to see people and teams being super clear that they're not going to do something or that they can't do it. And I think there's a problem here because it's an institutional and cultural thing. In a really positive way, the military and people who come from that background have a can-do attitude. They tend to want to say, yes, we can achieve X or Y objective. And they do try their best to achieve it. But I think we need to moderate that. It's okay to say, no, we can't, or actually you're not equipping us to, without ostracizing the people who are delivering the negative message that we don't want to hear. So I think there's a cultural issue here that I would just like to put on the table. But the other thing that I would also encourage when we're thinking about what we need to do when it comes to making sure we have the right means to deliver something is decoupling our plan from our funding cycle. Our planning horizon needs to be relevant to the problem at hand. If we don't think of these two things as, yes, they inform one another, but really as separate things, we're only going to plan based on a budgeting cycle, which will never get us to where we want to be. We won't really make the decisions in the midterm that we need to make to have the right team, to have an appropriate analysis of what the right allocation of resource is at the right time throughout the 3 to 5 to 7 years. How long have we been working in Iraq for? It's way more than we thought we would be engaged. And likewise, that's the case for NATO and every single other actor that intervened in Iraq after 2003. But I'm sure that most of them have been thinking on annual or maximum 3-year cycles, and that is a problem. Making sure we have the means in terms of personnel, team configuration, and resource in place in a way that is logical and relevant is key here. If we're going to intervene in institutions that work with the public in a way that defense doesn't really. So the Ministry of Interior, the police, their interface is very different. They're very complicated. They're dealing with parking penalties and all the stuff that the military doesn't deal with. Maybe gun licensing or domestic violence. They're dealing with situations that I bet you most people who are NATO advisors haven't ever really had to deal with because they come overwhelmingly from a defense background. We need to be very clear about the kind of human resources that we need to help advise on these issues and move the needle on these issues. And they may not be the personnel that we have or we naturally attract. So then there is a discussion to be had about how do we attract them? What kind of diplomatic skills do we need to have on the team? Technical skills, of course. Iraq has always been, quote unquote, hostile environment, which has meant that some parties have paid a great deal more for people to be there than others. So what does that mean for who you're attracting and what their motives are and what their incentives are?
Let's talk about lessons 9 and 10. These are about interrogating foundations, assumptions, and complementing partner efforts.
We come to a problem with our own biases and assumptions and our own perceptions on what we can affect. So I'm going to give you a very simple bias or an assumption that we made in relation to Iraq. And maybe we can call that the original sin of security sector reform in Iraq. And it was to presume that we can disband an entire security apparatus and then rebuild it wholesale in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. And of course, we couldn't do that. I'm being a bit comical, but that's a very low-hanging example of where we assumed certain things and that those assumptions in that case bordered on hubris in terms of our ability to affect a whole state apparatus. But there are many smaller assumptions that are made on a day-to-day basis that are strategic, although not as problematic in scale as the example that I gave you, but they can also be operational and they can be tactical. We make certain assumptions about stakeholders and how interested they are in working with us. We make certain assumptions about whether they perceive the problem the same way as we do, or is it just that it's a problem for us, but not really for them. When we train people, we make assumptions about whether they will then go and use that training. Why do we assume that knowledge results in improved behavior? Certain things like that, that we really need to put on the table. And I have seen that done, but usually in program speak, it's done by a monitoring, evaluation and learning specialist. And they tend to come in at the beginning of a program and they design their beautiful monitoring framework. And then they do that maybe for a week, 2-3 weeks, and then they leave for a year. And they've looked at assumptions from a monitoring perspective, but that's absolutely not what I'm talking about. Unless your assumptions are laid on the table from the very outset, your team is not really going to think about how we really work around these assumptions or how we monitor them and figure out whether our assumptions are valid or not. That is such an integral part of the strategy. And it was a bit of an innovation on my part on the ends, ways and means tool. But because at the heart of it is all of the stuff that we're assuming about whether we can even change the thing that we want to change, whether we have the means and can apply them in the right way, whether we have the means and can conceive of those in the right way, and whether we have the resources and can apply them in the right way. There is a second component to that last bit of the paper, which related to the way we work with other donors. My intention with that was just to put on the table the fact that, taking us back to the starting point of our conversation, NATO and really no actor can or even should act in isolation. We all have different strengths. Our access to certain actors will be quite different. Our soft power and our ability to project public confidence in what we're doing will be rather different too. In Iraq, from some of the broader work that I've done, I know that the EU is much more able to access and work with some actors than, say, the Brits and the US can, because they're just seen as less political. They come with less baggage. And that's a good thing. If we're sitting around the table and we're talking about how we leverage our strengths, that is a wonderful thing to be very upfront and say, okay, well, maybe the EU should lead on X, Y, Z. That does happen to a certain extent. But I think within MOI reform, how much more powerful would it be for us to agree jointly what it is that we're trying to change and then how every single actor contributes to that and really look beyond the program cycle to be more strategic. But that really takes leadership. That takes someone who's willing to transcend the structures that they're in to encourage those conversations and then to hold people to account for advancing that common interest. Usually how good we are at that really ties heavily into who the leaders are, who the diplomats are, who the heads of mission are. It's something that we really need to have on the table as a practical enabler or impediment to any change we're trying to achieve.
What are your recommendations?
If you could take two things away from what I'm saying, it would be this. If you're working with institutions or organizations that engage with the public, the most important thing is how the public will perceive them. That actually even bears on the reality of how they will then behave. Obviously, to an extent, the literature is very complex on this. But we're working with the Ministry of Interior and therefore with the Iraqi police in this case. How do the public perceive them? What are the public's main issues? Is it to do with improving or mediating tribal conflict? Is it to do with gun licensing? Is it to do with domestic violence and conflict? Who even gets to say who the public is? I'm not cited on what research has been done by actors like NATO into public perceptions before they've started the work. I would put a small amount of money on none having been done. That's a big problem, because who then will say whether things have improved or not? The MOI can self-report, your team can self-report. But the ultimate evidence will be in how they deliver for the public and whether the public perceive them as being more effective or not on a specific issue. Now, you can determine that issue very closely and therefore narrow down who in the public matters and whose view you're going to take on board. But still, you have to get to that point. Otherwise, we're kind of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, for want of a better analogy. They will be the ultimate arbiter of whether the police works, the Ministry of Interior works or not, and they will stand the most to benefit. And if they lose trust in those institutions, that really weakens the state. And there are very few interfaces between the public and the state. And it's not Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's the police. It's healthcare system. Those are the things that people deal with on a day-to-day basis. And if they don't work, they really affect the legitimacy of the government. That's my first piece of advice. Focus on the public. My second piece of advice is then look at the institution and slice across it. Don't just decide that you're going to focus on training, but look across it, diagnose the different problems and decide where you can apply your influence, your money, and whatever other resources you have. You may then decide it's going to be in very discrete parts, but you've done your homework and you know what's in and what's out.
Thank you so much, Andrea.
A pleasure, Stephanie. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can download the article at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Look for volume 54, issue 2. For more Army War College podcasts, check out Conversations on Strategy, SSI Live, Classic Dialogues, and A Better Peace.